Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National and via the web at abc.net.au/rn. Today, two very different stories of urban water.
Up to 1.5 million people in the eastern suburbs, city, inner west and parts of the south are having it mixed into their normal supplies this evening. Christina Keneally took the honour of pressing the go button.
For our children and our future, here we go.
Go Premier.
Like the sound of a jet engine warming up, the $2 billion project came to life.
Sydney's desalination plant opened last month and joined a number of similar plants across the country. Most state governments now believe that desalination is one of the best ways to secure urban water supplies. And every large urban centre now either has a desalination plant or is in the process of building one. Over the past 10 years, almost all Australian urban centres have run short of water, and most of us have been affected by water restrictions. Securing urban water in the face of increasing populations and climate change is now a critical social and political issue. Today, we compare Australia's urban water policies with those from Singapore. We've chosen Singapore because it's one of the most densely populated cities in Asia, and because in the space of just 10 short years, it's moved from being a nation heavily dependent on imported water to a nation almost self-reliant in water. How has it done that, and are there any lessons that we can learn? But let's begin at the beginning. For the first 100 years of white settlement, Australians were mainly responsible for their own water supply via rainwater tanks. Patrick Troy is Emeritus Professor of the Environment at the Australian National University.
When we first started, we actually, of course, exploited the stream, the tank stream in the middle of Sydney. And then they started to exploit, once the city started to grow and that water supply got polluted, they started to go further out. Also, whilst that was going on, households were encouraged to make their own provision, and they did that by both building cisterns in the ground. Usually they were brick-lined cisterns which they directed water from the roof and from the ground into the cistern. That was very often the most reliable supply that households had. Once they developed the more reliable and mass-produced rainwater tanks, which, you know, the corrugated iron round circular tanks, they were, of course, adopted, and so was the necessary guttering and so on to divert the water from the roof into those containers. That was, and of course, and still is, an important part of the supply, and in fact, in lots of farms and so on, it's the only source of supply of potable water.
That self-reliance ended in urban areas in the 19th century with the introduction of a reticulated water system. That is a system whereby pipes brought fresh water into a house and another set of pipes took the wastewater away.
Now, once they started to build the reticulated water supply system, many households had a tank that was big enough for most seasons, most years. So the economics of the provision of the water supply, reticulated water supply system, would be compromised by the continued reliance on tanks. So there was a strong argument on the economic grounds to do two things. One, they said that if the water supply was provided within a quarter of a mile of a block of land, then you had to pay for the water whether you used it or not. That meant that maintaining a rainwater tank was starting to make rainwater expensive. The economics of the provision of water supply wouldn't work unless they made the private supply of water, that is the rainwater tank, unless they made that illegal. So that's one of the reasons why they made them illegal, because they wanted to secure the revenue stream that was necessary to make the water supply system pay for itself. On top of that, however, they introduced health regulations. The health arguments were that the water off the roof contained an intolerable level of lead. The other argument that was used was that there was too much bird shit and rat shit that got washed in from the roof into the tanks and polluted the water. So you had the carrot of the reliable supply of potable water plus the stick of the regulation which banned tanks. And when we did that, we created the kind of problems we now have.
As far back as 1880, surveyors, engineers and geologists of the Sydney Water Board explored the mountain ranges, looking for the greatest rain catchment area and the place to build a dam. A dam to back up, to store enough water, so that never again would the people of Sydney go short, not even during the longest, driest summer. The engineers finally decided on the deep Warragamba Gorge.
That was in October 1946.
And the scheme was submitted to the members of the Water Board.
Australian cities traditionally relies on external forested or rural catchments for its water. We built dams around the outskirt, if you like, of our city and capture catchment runoff for its water supply.
Tony Wong is Professor of Engineering and Urban Design at Monash University and principal in the design firm EDOR.
The risks associated with continuing with just that one source of water that is perhaps most vulnerable to the effect of climate change. The effect of climate change is increasing global temperature, which means that our catchments will invariably be drier. And some climate change might reduce rainfall. But even if rainfall is not reduced substantially, you'll find that runoff from those catchments will reduce simply by the fact that the catchments are drier and it will take a lot more rain to sufficiently wet the catchments for runoff to occur.
Goulburn's main water supply, Pijar Dam, is effectively empty. Tourists and locals stare at the 25 metres of sunken shoreline to see how bad things have got in inland New South Wales.
Yeah, it's really low, the water. Don't know what's not going to be done.
Strict level 5 water restrictions have been enforced for the past 2 years, and Goulburn's mayor, Paul Stevenson, says the town is looking at all water options.
Look, trucking in, we've looked at trucking in water, and we've been helped by the Premier's department in that. Horribly expensive, but it would cost us $1 million a week, and no one wants to go down that track.
Many solutions have been suggested for trying to solve the problem of urban water supply. While there have been recycling projects in both urban and industrial areas, most Australian households don't recycle their water. Rainwater tanks have become more popular and are no longer banned, but the amount of water they collect in urban areas is still insignificant. The solution chosen or considered by most state governments is desalination.
Is desalination the answer to Australia's water shortage problem? The New South Wales government announced this evening that if Sydney's current water crisis persisted, a desalination plant would be built at Kurnell in Sydney's south. Perth has already decided on a plant to turn seawater into drinking water by 2007.
Sydney's controversial desalination plant is up and running. Right now, it's pumping 1,500 litres of water a second into Sydney's water supplies. The state government says it's an insurance policy against drought.
A lot of the decisions that we see made in terms of securing our water resources are decisions made that reflects poor strategic planning. We again look for quick solutions, and often they are the most expensive ones, but we look for quick solutions simply because we are not able to respond to the changes that we see fast enough. There are always going to be the search for those really quick fixes that in itself will just lead us to a trajectory of again relying on one source or being vulnerable to the fact that we are dependent on one source of water.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're comparing urban water policy in Australia and Singapore. While the rain that's fallen over the past month has replenished dams and reservoirs around many Australian towns and cities, the debate over water security continues. And perhaps as part of that debate, it's time we looked to other nations that have also had to deal with the issue of urban water security. Nations like Singapore. In 1965, when Singapore gained its independence, it imported almost all its water from Malaysia. Today, Singapore is virtually self-reliant in fresh water. Ku Teng Chai is the chief executive of PUB, the National Water Agency of Singapore.
In the 60s, we were a growing country, a country in a city, so to speak, rapidly growing, very much like many third world cities are today, overcrowded, overpopulated, all on this very tiny little island. Today, 700 square kilometers, but I think 40 years ago, it was probably only about, it was less than 600 square kilometers before we did a lot of extensive land reclamation. You know, we had droughts, we had flooding, we had polluted rivers, so there just wasn't enough water for this rapidly growing population. And so even from the times of the British, I think we had to look to Malaysia to supply us water. And I think that's, in a way, when we became an independent country in 1965, I think water became one of the strategic priorities for the country.
Yes, it was heavily dependent. I mean, it was a matter of like life and death. If Malaysia did not supply water to Singapore, it would be in dire straits. The whole population would just die of water starvation.
Dr. Lee Po Ong is a fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore.
Singapore just concentrated mainly on building reservoirs, but then there was also constraints because the land size of Singapore was small. So it couldn't allocate too many land areas to build reservoirs.
So how is it that Singapore, that relied so heavily on Malaysia for water and has limited catchment areas of its own, been able to become self-sufficient in fresh water?
Well, that's a very long story. I think the first thing, in a very simple way, is that there was a water planning unit that was formed in the Prime Minister's office, and the water planning unit started to draw what was called, and it's still called, the Water Master Plan. And the idea then, as now, is to really try to identify what are the different sources of water that we could try to procure to ensure Singapore's sustainability in the future. So the very first Water Master Plan was drawn up probably in the late 60s or early 70s. It has evolved into what we call today the four national taps.
The four national taps of Singapore are water imported from Malaysia, desalinated water, stormwater harvesting, and recycled sewage, which in Malaysia they call new water.
New water, I think it started, experimental processing started in the 1970s, but during those times it wasn't like economically feasible. It was still very expensive.
Can you explain what new water actually is?
New water is actually just water recycled from sewage. It's like water from our toilets and used water recycled. It goes through a three-stage process and a water osmosis process. It goes through ultraviolet filtration and osmosis and then filtering again. So it's actually just distilled water.
So they began in the 1970s to try and recycle water.
Yeah.
And why was it not successful then?
It was successful, but it wasn't economically feasible. It was just too expensive. I suppose technology then and technology now, it's different. You know, like they have developed new kinds of membrane. Nowadays, it's much cheaper to use. And so now the price of new water has gone down. In fact, wouldn't be too far away from just processing raw water, the cost of new water.
So when did they start again? You said in the 1970s.
1970s, they continued on to the 1980s. And then I think in the 1990s, it started in greater seriousness again. I think they went to the U.S. to see how water was recycled and learned about their technologies and brought them back to Singapore and modified and adapted it and subsequently redeveloped it to suit Singapore conditions.
How do we use the water? We primarily put them into a second pipe for industrial use, for the electronic factories, for petrochemical factories, for the power plants. But a small percentage, 1 to 2%, is put into the reservoirs where it's mixed with the rainwater before being supplied to drinking water. But on the other strategy, which is more on the public education and public relations front, I think we tried to explain clearly to the population that this is really very good water. The standard of the water is, in fact, way beyond what is needed for drinking. It is very high quality water. And that's why we branded it New Water. We created a New Water Visitor Center next to one of the first New Water plants in Bedok, where the process of New Water is explained in a very simple way, using computer graphics and so on, so that even school children could understand how New Water is produced using advanced membrane technology and why it is very, very safe. We bottled the New Water into little bottles with colorful designs, and we distributed these New Water bottles extensively to the population. In fact, on 2002, when the nation celebrated National Day, more than 65,000 people, including the government leaders, the Prime Minister and the whole cabinet, drank a toast to the nation using New Water.
So was there much infrastructure required to be put in to actually get the recycling process happening?
Yes, I think it takes a few years to build one plant. But at the moment, Singapore already has four plants operating around the island and a fifth one about to be ready, I think, in a year or two.
What percentage of water that comes out of people's houses now is recycled?
It gets treated and recycled. It doesn't go to the sea.
So 100% of water that comes out of...
I can't give you an exact figure, but I would think most of it would get recycled.
And of that water that gets recycled, you said that it goes into the reservoir, so it doesn't go literally from the recycling plant back to into people's houses.
Okay, it goes to the reservoir for consumers, but for industries that require pure water, it goes directly to them.
So what percentage of Singapore's water does it actually now make up now?
About 10%, I would think. About 10% of water is new water. But then in about 3 years' time, we could produce about 30% of Singapore's water requirements.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're comparing urban water policy in Australia and Singapore. The third national tap is harvested rainwater, and unlike other nations, Singapore collects rainwater in both rural and urban areas.
We were the first, I think, and I think we are still probably leading in the world in stormwater harvesting. So we try to develop reservoirs to try and harvest as much of the water that falls into Singapore. We developed urban reservoirs, which are in urban areas. For us to be able to build these reservoirs, certain conditions have to be in place. In other words, the land use planning has to be properly done. The environmental controls have to be properly done. So the issue of water supply went beyond just building reservoirs. I think it went into urban planning, into environmental planning, into the regulations to make sure that the water is kept clean. We went into providing a island-wide, completely separate sewage system, which is distinct from the stormwater system. And that was a very major program. And that helped to clean up the rivers as well. Then on the flooding side, we built this drainage infrastructure, and today we've got this Marina Barrage that is a reservoir right in the heart of the city that helps us to prevent flooding in the low-lying parts of the city, but at the same time also act as a reservoir.
Since 2 years ago, when they now have significant confidence in water treatment technology, do they then realize that perhaps another source of water is urban stormwater? And in this case, Singapore has about 2.5 meters of rainfall every year. A few months ago, they've completed their project called the Marina Barrage Project, which essentially converts Marina Bay into a freshwater reservoir right in the middle of Singapore City, with its catchment entirely made of urban areas. It is through this initiative that they are now moving towards water-sensitive urban design in progressively retrofitting the urban environment such that green spaces and green infrastructure are introduced to cleanse the stormwater before it's discharged into marina reservoir. Not so much to enable it to be to drinking standard, but to ensure that by converting Marina Bay into a reservoir, it now is a collection of all stormwater pollutants into that bay. It doesn't get flushed out to sea, as has been the case when it was a marine bay. And so they needed to ensure that the quality of the reservoir itself, the water quality, is such where it is not going to cause the type of algal problems that you see in many, many reservoirs in cities. And so they have now embarked on a process of equipping their urban environments with appropriate water-sensitive urban design initiative to commence cleansing of stormwater prior to it discharging into marine reservoir.
In our first urban reservoirs that we built in the mid-70s, we built them in what we call our new towns, our public housing new towns. So we planned the new towns with the idea that we were going to collect as much water as we can. So we made sure that the land use was such that there were no highly pollutive activities. The kind of industries that were there were very tightly controlled. By the time it came to building the marina reservoir, which, as I said, is the reservoir that's right in the heart of the city. So all the water that falls into the city center, in Orchard Road, the shopping belt, all that drains into marina reservoir. So it's a huge challenge because, unlike the new towns where you could plan from scratch, I think in the old city, there are parts that are old and developed over many years. So it's more of a challenge. And fortunately, I think membrane technology came along. So today, the water that is collected in marina reservoir, we know we could now use membrane technology to purify the water.
And there is also a desalination element in the water mix in Singapore as well,
yes,
isn't there?
That's the fourth national tap. We built our first desalination plant in 2005, and that plant can supply about 10% of our water needs. But I must point out that while it is possible for us to produce lots of desalinated water, the energy required and therefore the cost to produce desalinated water is at least twice as much as recycling. For us, recycling really is important as a viable source of water going forward. Desalination, yes, is possible, but we will always place our priority on doing as much recycling first as we can, simply because it's a cheaper source of water.
So how much, in terms of rainwater harvesting, what does that add?
That would add about 10% of Singapore's present water supplies. Currently, Singapore already has about 60% of its water supplies domestically and imports 40% from Malaysia. So by 2011, about perhaps 70% could come from its reservoirs, and 30% could come from new water or desalination.
So that's a big change. If we go back to 1965, then that's a dramatic change or increase in the amount of water that Singapore has been able to produce itself.
That's right. Yeah, it's been quite a dramatic change, and within a very short period of time. I mean, new water only came into the picture. I mean, in the 70s they started exploring, but it only became operational in 2003, and for desalinated water in 2005. So yeah, within a very short period of time, Singapore has achieved near self-sufficiency in water. And that's why nowadays you don't see that kind of bilateral negotiations between Singapore and Malaysia centering on water.
Tony Wong from Monash University is a world expert in water-sensitive urban design. He assisted the Singapore government in redesigning the urban landscape, making it more suitable for stormwater collection.
When the government of Singapore, led by the Public Utilities Board, made the decision to now concentrate on harvesting stormwater, they very quickly realized that coupled with the providing the reservoir out at Marina Bay is the need to now embed all this green infrastructure into their city design, such that they perform almost like kidneys in the city as far as stormwater is concerned to cleanse that water. So they came up to Melbourne to have a look at what all this is about. Melbourne Water is a significant advocate for the adoption of water-sensitive urban design in Melbourne, of course, for aimed at the protection of Port Phillip Bay. And I was fortunate to be introduced to the chief executive of the Public Utilities Board during the course of those workshops, and was subsequently engaged to put together a framework for the institutionalizing water-sensitive urban design in Singapore.
So in lots of ways, even though the research has been done here in Australia, the actual application of it, is Singapore really one of the first large-scale places where this has happened?
Government support is essential. And the planning framework in Australia is often fragmented between the roles of federal government, the roles of state government, and the roles of local government. And in Singapore, the issue of water security is a national security issue. And the support all the way up to the Prime Minister is immense. And we find that what we've been trying to do for the last 10 years or so in Australia, I think Singapore was able to achieve that in 2 and a bit years.
Despite having developed much of the urban design now being used in Singapore, Australian cities and towns still don't harvest stormwater in any serious or systematic way. Patrick Troy again.
One of the situations we now have is we take water from one ecosystem, we pump it to another, and when we've used it, we discharge it into a third ecosystem. Namely, we take it from the country, use it in the city, and then push it out into the harbours and bays on which the cities are built. But at the same time, we ignore all the water that falls on the city and treat that as stormwater, and we see that as a different sort of problem. Now, if you took, and I remind you that there isn't a major city in Australia, certainly none of the coastal cities, that doesn't have enough water fall on it through the course of its years, even its worst drought years, to provide all of the water that's the needs of that city at the present levels of consumption. It's a question of how you decide to go about it. Now, if you actually install rainwater tanks and cut off a lot of that rainwater, stormwater, you'd not only sort out the pollution problem downstream, you'd actually also be able to use that rainwater for consumption in the house.
So what you're saying, in all the major cities of Australia, even in drought years, there's enough rain falling on those cities to actually cover those cities' water consumptions?
Yes, but it's a question of how you collect it and how you distribute it. That's the issue. And the real problem has been we've just discarded that problem. We've just sort of, you pick up the water from one place because it's clean and cheap to get, then use it and you discharge as quickly as you can into the ocean. And you don't take any notice at all of the stormwater problem. A stormwater runoff problem is actually the most important source of pollution for Botany Bay, Sydney Harbour, Port Phillip Bay, Brisbane River, Swan River, etc. All that stuff that comes off when you discharge the stormwater flows through the drainage channels into those harbours and bays and rivers on which the cities are built. That is true.
So I'm just wondering, when you look at cities around the world, what do you think Singapore, what are the key lessons from Singapore's experience over the last 40 years that you think are probably worth other cities having a look at?
The principles that we have used to try and solve our water problems are easily adapted to many cities in the world. Not all cities are alike, I know, but the principle of really trying to tackle it systematically in a holistic way, looking at the supply side, using technology, using recycling, using urban stormwater harvesting, desalination if you are close to the sea, and on the other hand, also managing demand, water conservation, and adopting the correct policies like pricing policy, taking a very holistic approach to water management. I think these are basic principles that we are sure that could be applied to other cities.
Ku Teng Chai, Chief Executive of PUB, the National Water Agency of Singapore, ending today's program. Our other guests were Patrick Troy, Emeritus Professor of the Environment at the ANU, Dr. Lee Po Ong, Fellow at the Institute of South Asian Studies in Singapore, and Professor Tony Wong from Monash University. Thanks to today's sound engineer, Phil McKellar, and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, I'm Beth Yap, inviting you to join me for Elsewhere, a program for travellers. Take a journey through the ABC's vast archives for stories and sounds from around the world. This week, the South Island of New Zealand.
I can see the silhouette of individual trees against the grey sky.
South Island by Chris Abrams and Sherry DeLeese on Elsewhere. You can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.